It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The U.S. Supreme Court agreed to take up a case that could shape laws involving homelessness across the country. The court will rule on whether a city in the state of Oregon has the right to enforce a local law that would ban unhoused people from camping on public property. It's a challenge to a circuit court ruling that found that these types of laws are considered cruel and unusual punishment as laid out by the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. A similar law has been proposed in Wisconsin that would make it illegal for someone to camp on public property unless it's done in police-supervised temporary shelters designated by the local government. Authors of these types of laws say they'd create safer, cleaner alternatives to people sleeping on the street or sidewalks. Opponents believe this kind of legislation criminalizes homelessness and doesn't solve the larger problem. Our next guest is an expert on laws involving homelessness. She's here to help us understand the potential impact of this Supreme Court case. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think municipalities should be allowed to ban homeless encampments on public property or individual people camping on, say, the courthouse lawn? Why or why not? What kind of things do you think local governments should do when it comes to homelessness? What questions do you have about these types of laws? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Maria Foscarinas is founder and former executive director of the National Homelessness Law Center. She's currently a lecturer in law at the Columbia Law School. Maria, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Maria, I laid out the broad strokes of that case there. Can you take us a little more through this situation that's coming out of the Western United States, but laws that could be relevant anywhere in the country?
Sure, absolutely. And they are relevant because for the past past couple of decades, we've seen an increase in the number of cities responding to homelessness by literally making it a crime to live in public places, even when there's no alternative. That's the issue that the Supreme Court has agreed to take up. Is it a violation of the U.S. Constitution to make it a crime to sleep in public when you have no other alternative? It's an important issue. It's an issue that many people think, and that includes me, has been already decided by prior Supreme Court precedent. So it's a bit of a concern why the Supreme Court thinks it needs to take this up. The case it will be reviewing comes from the Ninth Circuit. It involved a dispute in Grants Pass, Oregon, a law that punished people for sleeping outside with blankets or any kind of covering, even though the city had absolutely no shelter. So that's the issue. Can a city make it a crime to simply exist in a public space without shelter?
Now, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals invoked the clause of the Eighth Amendment we've mentioned involving cruel and unusual punishment. There were members, I understand, of that court who disagreed with that read on it. Do you see that Eighth Amendment prohibition applying in this case?
Absolutely. So the Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, and there is Supreme Court precedent from the 60s that says when you punish someone for their status or for involuntary actions that are otherwise harmless, then that is cruel and unusual punishment. So here, when a city punishes someone for sleeping outside when they have no alternative, that is cruel and unusual punishment. That's what the court said. I think that's the correct decision. And, you know, why this Supreme Court feels that it needs to review it is a concern.
Some local governments and even state governors have argued that this is not harmless, that there are difficulties in maintaining public cleanliness, policing these communities, in driving off potential business from tourists and others. There is a harm, and that cities, local governments do have an interest in regulating, you know, where an encampment might pop up. What would you say to that concern at the local level?
Right. There absolutely is a harm, and I didn't mean to suggest there wasn't. But the harm, there is a harm, and the most harm is to the to people themselves who have to sleep outside, who have to live outside. Of course, it's a harm to a community to have encampments. No one wants that. I certainly don't disagree with that. I don't think anybody can disagree. But the point is that we're not talking about people who are committing anything that would be considered a crime. We're talking about people sleeping. That's a basic human need. It's not criminal conduct normally. The problem here is that there is no place for people to sleep, no place for people to exist. So the issue is, what do you do in response to that? Do you simply pass a law to make it a crime? Or do you actually provide places for people to be? And I think many people believe that the solution for cities is to provide housing, at the very least provide some kind of shelter. But really, to solve the problem of homelessness, you have to provide housing. And that's the answer. Making it a crime is not going to solve the problem. It's not going to solve the harm that cities are so concerned about. It's certainly not going to solve the problem for the people themselves.
Talking to Maria Foscarinas, founder of the National Homelessness Law Center, looking at a case coming out of the Western United States, relevant around the country, though, on what ability local governments have to regulate, to criminalize mostly homeless people camping, sleeping in public places. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. Steve is with us on the line in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
So my question is, you know, if it's cruel and unusual to have a homeless person not be able to sleep outside, you know, in minus 18 degree weather, why not? Wouldn't it be cruel and unusual to kick them out of, let's say, a professor's office who's working at a public institution? And wouldn't that be more cruel to send them outside? So can homeless people sleep inside government buildings that are publicly owned?
Steve, thanks for the call. Maria, how would you tackle Steve's question?
I think that's one potential immediate solution. You know, open public buildings. There are solutions that can be implemented right away. The true solution is creating affordable housing. And this country has not invested in affordable housing. It's, in fact, disinvested. There used to be much more support for affordable housing, and now there's very little. But in the meantime, open public buildings, yes, that's a potential solution.
Thanks for the call, Steve, at 800-642-1234. Maria, I want to talk about that, the concept of trying to solve the homelessness problem and provide housing in the first place. It seems that short of that, we're going to be arguing about symptoms, in effect. If people are homeless, where do they sleep? Where do they stay in the absence of housing? What would you like to see done to tackle that fundamental, the cause of the problem in the first place?
Well, I think you put it, that's exactly right, that these responses are addressing symptoms, not the causes. And the real solution is a much, much greater investment in affordable housing. And that's, you know, there are countries that fund what they call social housing, and this country has not. And, you know, we used to have an investment in what we called public housing, but that has long since been eliminated, and that funding has been decimated, and, you know, public housing has been stigmatized. So we don't meet the need that people have in this country for housing. Right now, the programs that exist to support poor people in housing address only one quarter of the need. So, you know, there's a huge lack, and it's not just people who are poor. I think middle-class Americans are feeling the pinch of the lack of affordable housing. It's a real crisis in this country, and it requires a fundamental shift in our priorities to invest in those resources.
We're talking to Maria Foscarinas, founder and former executive director of the National Homelessness Law Center. She's with us today for a look at a U.S. Supreme Court case on whether or not local governments can ban homeless camping on public property. The court agreed to take up that case after ruling in a circuit court in the western U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of rules do you think there should be around homeless camps in communities? What kind of alternatives would you like to see to address homelessness? Have you been homeless yourself? Are you watching these things going on in your own community? What would you like to see done to solve it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Maria Foscarinas, founder and former executive director of the National Homelessness Law Center, currently a lecturer at the Columbia Law School, talking today about laws aiming to ban homeless encampments and camping in public places, and the U.S. Supreme Court agreeing to take up the issue. You could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Maria, some legislation, including one of the proposals here in Wisconsin, based on a model from a group, I believe, in Texas, says, okay, local governments can criminalize this public camping if they provide police-supervised shelters as an alternative. What do you think of that approach?
I'm not sure what they mean by a police supervised shelter. And a lot depends on what exactly is being offered to people. You know, not shelter is not the solution to homelessness. Housing is, but, you know, shelters also vary. There are different types of shelters. Some shelters have curfews. You have to be out or you have to be in by a certain time. That doesn't work for you if you have a job, for example, that goes overnight or goes late. So not all shelters are appropriate, and not all shelters would fit within the Ninth Circuit decision. I'm suspicious because of what you're describing. I don't know the details, but the group in Texas is promoting an approach that is punitive and that tells communities that they can't invest funding in housing. So I don't think that that's a good approach. It doesn't sound like the right approach to me. And certainly police supervised shelter is not a solution.
Let's go back to our callers. Paul is with us in Milwaukee. Paul, hi.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what'd you want to bring up, Paul?
Well, a couple of things as I sit here. I mean, it's great on paper to fund housing and all that, but where is that money supposed to come? I mean, as a taxpayer, my money is paying for these public places anyways. So if someone were to camp out in my shed, if that's trespassing, that's against the law. I view public property as the same. If I'm paying taxes, they can't camp there free of charge. And so I'm just curious, where is the funding supposed to come? I mean, I'm all for solutions, but just giving away free housing is not it.
Paul, thanks for the call. Maria, go ahead.
Well, so to make clear, we're not talking about free housing. We're talking about affordable housing. But it's important to realize that by not solving homelessness, that's not free. Homelessness, allowing people to be homeless, is very expensive. When people are living on the street, they have more health needs. They have more health crises. They tend not to have any kind of health insurance. That costs a lot of money in emergency room and in preventable illness. So it's not free. And certainly deploying police to enforce these kinds of laws that we're discussing is also costly. So it actually is less expensive to provide housing to people than to enforce these kinds of laws. And, you know, it doesn't have to be free housing. Many homeless people work or else they get disability benefits. They can pay something for housing, but the housing has to be there. That's the real solution. So it's a matter of using taxpayer dollars in a way that's smarter and effective. Right now, it's just using taxpayer dollars in a way that doesn't work.
Thanks for the call. Paul, we'll go to Jay now with us in Juneau. Jay, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. So some of the things, before I get on with this, I'm going to say some of the things I've heard your guests say, I kind of get where she's coming from, but to be honest, this giving free homes to homeless people will not work. Okay, like Paul, I wonder where the money's coming from. And two, I was homeless. I was a runaway as a kid, and I was good at it, so I made it through to my late teens and slept in doorways, you know, everything you can find. That's where I had to lay my head, was where I would lay my head. I would not go to shelters because the shelters are dangerous. And so therein, I kind of agree with your guess. There has to be, for the people that are actually making the pathway out for themselves, they need help. I don't think you should give them the complete handout. I think they should have to figure some of this out on their own, because that's where this all changes, is in the person's mind. They have to come to a point where they begin to have pride in themselves. I hate using that word, but yes, they have to have pride in themselves. They have to be, you know,
Point taken, Jay. Thanks a lot for the call. Now, Marie, and I've heard this argument that people need to be motivated to get out of the situation that led them into homelessness. I've also seen arguments for the housing first approach, as you mentioned, not necessarily free, but affordable housing for people who are currently homeless, being the first step to let them do all that other stuff Jay was talking about in the first place. Your thoughts on that?
Yes, and thank you very much, Jay, for the call. Very important. Yes, Housing First is a program that's been proven to work. And the idea is that you need a place to live before you need some stability before you can address any other issues that you might have. So Housing First is a model where you have that stability, you have a place to live. And then if you need to work on other things, for example, people who are homeless might have mental health issues or maybe a drug addiction. Not everybody, not most people, but some people do. And the idea is that to work on any of those issues, you need the stability of a place to live. So that's Housing First. And it's not a handout. It's not even free. People pay whatever they can, 30% of whatever income they have. And people do work. People do sometimes have disabilities and get disability payments. So this is not a handout. It's the first step to be able to do whatever other work you need to do to get your life on better footing.
Jay, thanks for sharing your thoughts and your experience. We've got Chris with us now calling from Eau Claire. Chris, hi.
Hi. So I worry that using this term homelessness is a bit pejorative. It comes with this imagery in the mind of what homelessness is. And there's many different kind of interpretations of what homelessness is. There's many people that are perhaps poor or have bad credit scores that have put them in a position where it's difficult to get homeless, to get housing. So there's many different kind of variances of this question. And then second of all, legislating, when you say creating a place that is police patrolled places for these people to have somewhere to stay, well, that certainly sounds like a jail to me. And I don't know if that's the right interpolation, but legislating homelessness seems like a way to try and legislate morality here, something I don't want to see. So legislate it out of what I'm looking at.
Chris, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Your thoughts on Chris's thoughts, Maria.
Yes, thank you, Chris. I think that's a really important point. There is a lot of stigma attached to homelessness and to people who are experiencing it. And there's a perception that people are dangerous. And that raises a big concern about the police supervised shelters. And I thank you, Chris, for pointing that out. The people who are homeless are more often victimized by other people than are dangerous themselves. And I think that's really a result of that stigma that exists in people's in public perception. So it's important to recognize that people who become homeless are often people who are just down on their luck for whatever reason. They've lost a job, they've been evicted, they've had an unexpected health crisis. I mean, right now, 49% of all renters in this country are living on a kind of an edge. They're paying over 30% of their income for housing. And that means that any unexpected crisis can push them over that edge. So it's important for us to recognize that homelessness can happen to a large swath of people. So let's stop thinking of people who become homeless as somehow, you know, as people who are somehow at fault or people looking for handouts or people who are who we stigmatize. It could happen to many of us. So having some empathy, I think, would go a long way to figuring out solutions.
Thanks for that call. And Maria, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Maria Foscarinas is founder and former executive director of the National Homelessness Law Center and a lecturer at the Columbia Law School. She's with us today for a look at laws restricting homelessness and the U.S. Supreme Court agreeing to take up a case over laws on camping on public property. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. All eyes were on Iowa earlier this week as the state's Republican caucuses took place on Monday night. The Associated Press declared former President Donald Trump the winner early in the night. He won by a big margin, taking home over 50% of the votes, with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley coming in second and third, splitting most of the rest. The caucuses saw a lower turnout than usual, with just 110,000 Republicans turning out to vote, under 15% of Iowa Republicans. Our next guest is here for a look at the meaning of the results and a look ahead at the presidential primary season. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on the results in Iowa? Were you surprised by them? Are you happy or disappointed to see former President Trump do well in the state? If you are an Iowa Republican voter, you can hear us there, some of you. Did you go to a caucus and cast your ballot? What are your thoughts on what came out of it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Kathleen Dolan is a distinguished professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, co-editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Political Science. Kathy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
I guess the big question was a big surprise going to come out of Iowa earlier this week? And the answer is no. No surprise came out. Were these the results pretty, you and everyone were watching for?
Yes, the result on Monday night was really no surprise. Former President Trump had been up significantly in the polls. Neither Governor DeSantis nor former Ambassador Haley seemed to be making much traction in most polls that we've seen. So it really was, you know, between the two of them, a fight for sort of second and third. And I think the only question was the size of former President Trump's margin of victory.
Now, the deal with caucuses and the Iowa caucus, I think in particular, was, okay, this is one. It's not about the advertising or the national profile. It's, you know, the candidate going from county to county, meeting people, making connections, blah, blah, blah. Is that not true anymore?
Well, you know, they say that it's not about the advertising, and it is, because, I mean, the point of the caucuses is to get in a room and try to convince mm-hmm. your friends and neighbors to support your candidate. And that's exactly what television ads do. So the Iowa caucuses are, you know, sort of a historical anachronism that we're still using. People in Iowa certainly like the attention. They like to be first in the nation. They try to preserve, you know, the sort of special nature of the caucus. But, you know, the candidates are expected in most circumstances to spend a lot of time in the state and court voters individually. But, you know, endorsements from elites and television ad campaigns and those sorts of things certainly help as well.
There have been arguments over the years for either party. Why does Iowa get to go first? Does it really represent the country? Does the caucus model give us a good sense of what's going on? Democrats dropped it as the first thing after kind of the fiasco 4 years ago where there's a lot of trouble, you know, counting the caucus ballots. Is there a case to be made that maybe Iowa shouldn't be first for either party?
Yes, I think the answer from my perspective as a political scientist is absolutely yes. Iowa is one of the less representative states in the United States. The people who take part in the caucuses are among the less representative Iowans. And so we had an enormously small number, enormously small, that's not the right thing to say, 110,000 people in a country of 335 million have, you know, set off this process, and everybody's like, well, it's over. Okay, it's done. And, you know, it's an incredibly unrepresentative group of people. The caucuses themselves are, you know, somewhat problematic from a democracy perspective, you know, and democratic with a small D, as opposed to the alternative, which is the primary elections that most states use that generally get much higher turnout, that generally make it a lot easier for people to participate. And so I would argue, yes, I think that Iowa is probably not, shouldn't necessarily be the bellwether.
Kathleen Dolan is with us from UW-Milwaukee, political scientist there. We are talking about the presidential primary campaign kicked off for the Republicans with the Iowa caucus earlier this week. New Hampshire coming up early next week. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think former President Trump has this all locked up? Do you see that as a good or bad thing? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kathy, you mentioned some people came out of Iowa saying, yep, well, this is done. Is it? Is there anything that could shake things up in New Hampshire or beyond that makes this not a guaranteed renomination for former President Trump?
Probably not at this point. You know, it will take the former president until sometime in early March, you know, if we get through the Super Tuesday primaries, to have enough delegates locked up through this primary and caucus process to really be assured that he will get the nomination. But even in this short term, you know, we're moving on to New Hampshire next Tuesday. Governor DeSantis's campaign, you know, doesn't look to be strong. He won't do well in New Hampshire. He is unlikely to do well in South Carolina. The super PAC that is supporting his campaign started issuing layoff notices to employees this morning. So, you know, he has said that he has enough money to stay in it through South Carolina, but that's just a couple of weeks from now. So I think it's, you know, I think there's a very small window for him. I think former Ambassador Haley, you know, is projected to do well in New Hampshire. I can't imagine she wins New Hampshire unless the independent voters in New Hampshire who are allowed to vote, you know, are coming out strong. But even if she does well in a second place and keeps things close to the former president, you know, she still has a long road to go herself. She, as the former governor of South Carolina, is still lagging badly in the polls there. And if you don't win or come, you know, really exceed expectations in some early contests, there is a momentum, you know, that builds behind a single candidate who keeps winning contests. And then it's just impossible to keep up in terms of money and attention. And so I think we'll know sooner rather than later. But I think we know where it's headed.
I want to talk about that a little bit. Now, just over 3 years ago, President Trump, after losing the election in November 2020, did something no U.S. president has done, rejected the outcome of the election, launched a long campaign in courts and recounts and pressure on local elected officials and the vice president, and convened a demonstration to persuade Congress and the vice president to overturn the results of his election loss. How does somebody come from that to being the presumptive nominee a few years later? A lot of people are spilling a lot of ink on this question. Kathy, wanted to hear what you think about that.
Well, what I would say is that, as you say, everything you said that former President Trump did after the 2020 election is unprecedented in our history. But you have to think about the fact that he has been in the public psyche since he started his campaign in 2015. So he spent 4 years as president. He spent 4 years denying that he isn't president. And that's really been 8 years for his step-by-step, inch-by-inch, sort of capture and solidifying his control of the contemporary Republican Party. If you look at where we are now with one state's events behind us, the number of sitting governors and members of Congress and other elected officials who have already endorsed former President Trump for the nomination is itself unprecedented. You hear people talk about him having captured the Republican Party, and it is true. I mean, he came out today, or somebody in his campaign came out today and said that people who have not yet endorsed him have 2 weeks to do so, or it will be remembered that they did not. Former President Trump has solidified a hold on a national political party in a way that we have not seen, certainly in a very, very long time.
And a survey of Iowa caucus goers here, 3 in 10 said they believed that Joe Biden had been legitimately elected. So by my math, 7 in 10 said they didn't. Basically, a decent part of a party has embraced an alternative reality as they go to the caucus or the polls.
Yes. That poll, that pre-caucus poll that you're citing, it did say better than 6 and 10% of respondents did not believe that President Biden was legally elected. But keep in mind that you had 110,000 people participate in the caucuses. The people who said that they did not believe in President Biden's election tended to be the oldest of the voters. They tended to be the people who called themselves very conservative. They were the evangelical voters, and they were more likely male. So it's a piece of a very small group of people. Now, having said that, we see national public opinion polls that show us that 40 to 50 and upwards percent of Republicans in general also believe that. And what we have to accept as a political society is, as I said, from the structural perspective, former President Trump has captured the Republican Party. But he has captured a good percentage of the Republican base and the Republican voters. We don't know what's going to happen in November. I mean, presuming he's the nominee, we don't know what will happen in the November election. But we know that there is a very steady core of Republican voters who believe his lies. They believe, the things that he has told them for 8 years now. They believe what their media are telling them. And it is a very challenging reality for us to accept as a political society, regardless of the candidate you support and regardless of the party you might support, the diminished basis of shared truth that we have as a society is incredibly dangerous.
Kathleen Dolan is with us, distinguished professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about the results of the Iowa caucus and what's coming up for the Republican presidential nomination quest after former President Trump carried the state's Republican caucus goers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Want to hear your thoughts on the likelihood of a Trump re-nomination as a Republican candidate? Do you think it is going to happen no matter what? Are you glad? If so, or are you worried? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with political science professor Kathleen Dolan about the outcome of the Iowa caucus and the Republican presidential nomination field. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. When I say the words Biden-Trump rematch, how does that make you feel? Do you want to see that in November? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring out a caller now. Pat is with us in Three Lakes. Pat, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I think one of the reasons, and I have a comment. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I believe that Donald Trump didn't have to spend a lot of time in Iowa is because the evangelical church preached his message for him. A lot of the people in evangelical church and others, I guess, believe that he's anointed by God. And whether it's a separation of church and state is a question for other people above my pay grade to answer. But I do know that his message is preached in the evangelical churches, some of them. And on TV today, I was watching the Jim Baker show because the rest of the comedies were over, and he preached Donald Trump anointed by God for half the show. So,
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. Kathy, strong evangelical support for President Trump. If you'd said 10 years ago Donald Trump is going to be the favorite candidate of evangelical white conservative Christians, I don't know. I don't think anybody would have believed that, but here we are. What are your thoughts on how that's shaken out?
Well, I think that it is another example of the sort of upside down world that we are living in the last 8 years. And again, inch by inch, step by step, three Supreme Court justices at a time. Former President Trump has captured many evangelical voters. He campaigns very explicitly on the idea that he is responsible for the overturn of the right to an abortion in the case Roe versus Wade. He said just the other day, I appointed three justices who helped to overturn that. That was because of me. And there are, you know, you can read interviews with evangelicals who will say that, you know, there are aspects of the former president's life that do not sort of fit with their ideology, but they have higher goals and higher values. And among those was the successful overturning of the right to abortion. The caller is not wrong that there is an increasing segment of the evangelical movement that wants to present and paint the former president as ordained by God, as, you know, sort of the embodiment of, you know, God's work on earth, and that is taking hold, and that is something that his campaign is happy to capitalize on. So you're right that nobody saw this coming, but it is, you know, another example of the sort of, you know, increased control that he has over the party and its faithful.
Thanks for the call, Pat, at 800-642-1234. I want to briefly look at the Democratic side of things, Kathy. No Democratic caucus in Iowa. I think that was the plan. New Hampshire, President Biden isn't on the ballot. That's not really a thing for Democrats. There have been a couple challengers announced, a congressman, Dean Phillips, and some others. What's going on in the Democratic side of things? Presumably an incumbent president has a real inside track here.
Yes, of course. excuse me, callers and listeners may remember that after the 2020 primary season where South Carolina was really the state that solidified now President Biden's, you know, path to the nomination, he and many other members of the Democratic Party and the Democratic literal party structure and the leaders, you know, came to believe that Iowa and New Hampshire really shouldn't go first because of their small and unrepresentative nature, even on the Democratic side. And so the Iowa is not caucusing, obviously, as we saw, they're doing a mail-in ballot. New Hampshire is actually being sanctioned by the Democratic National Committee for their sort of, you know, recalcitrance, and they're pushing forward in having a primary. President Biden removed himself from the ballot because he does not want them to go first. And so neither of those states will offer much in terms of hoopla for President Biden's reelection campaign. But, you know, we'll move on to South Carolina and we'll move on to Nevada and all the other states. And while there are people like Representative Phillips who are trying to challenge him from inside the party, at this point, there's no concern that he won't receive the nomination.
We're talking to Kathleen Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Co-Editor-in-Chief of the American Journal of Political Science, looking at the Iowa caucus outcome on the Republican side of things. There wasn't one for the Democrats, and the future of the race for the nominations in both parties. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Debbie is with us in Madison. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. I'm a little nervous, but I don't call in too often, but I'm a Republican, and I really don't, you know, that's one select group that have nominated him in the Iowa caucus. I don't put much stock in it. But what I do say is I'm very concerned that Trump will be our nominee, and I want to hear from some thoughtful, good Republicans. And I don't. And I'm probably going to change. I'll change my vote if it's Trump on the ballot. But this is a man that's a danger to our world, period. It's unbelievable what we're seeing. And it's frightening. So that's all my comment.
Debbie, thanks a lot for the call. Kathy, I think all along, even since 2015, there have been some Republicans in Debbie's camp concerned about Donald Trump. Not enough of them, apparently, to make a difference. And then the Liz Cheneys of the world who do push back on Donald Trump, well, out of a job, at least out of the job as a member of Congress.
Yes, no. What Debbie articulates is not, you know, she's certainly not alone there in Madison feeling that way. But former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, you know, would argue that he has tried his best to be the voice that Debbie wanted to hear. And there just simply aren't enough Republicans like Debbie who want to hear it to vote for him. Certainly, you know, Governor DeSantis and former Ambassador Haley have tried to push back against former President Trump a little bit, but not in taking him on directly. Former Governor Christie was really the only candidate in the race who was willing to try to speak to the danger that Christie believes former President Trump represents for our system. But there simply aren't enough takers. Now, you know, Debbie says that the results in Iowa do not, for her, confirm that former President Trump is on the path to the nomination. And she is absolutely right to wait and see what happens, because 110,000 people have voted and only half of those people chose the former president. So we really should heed that idea and not look toward this as any kind of determinative outcome. But, you know, as we look at public opinion polls nationally and as we look at polls in the various states that are coming next, the issue is, as I said, you know, sort of by early March, if we have seen momentum where state by state the former president is winning, you know, then the momentum may well carry him to this nomination. But it is the case, as you say, that there have been people who have said never Trump since the beginning, and there simply are not enough of those people to deny him the nomination.
Debbie, thanks for the call. And Kathy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Kathleen Dolan is Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee and co-editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Political Science. She is with us for a look at the results of the Iowa caucuses and what it all means for the Republican nomination process going ahead as we head into this big election year. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, some drug companies are paying settlements to Wisconsin and other states as compensation for damages in the opioid crisis. Find out what the money could actually be used for here in the state and how those decisions get made. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. A lot of us humans like to watch TV, and a lot of the shows we like to watch feature other humans. So what do dogs like to watch on TV? You might guess correctly, they like to watch other dogs. That's one finding in a new survey of dog owners and research at UW-Madison reported on by WPR's Rob Menser. You may ask, why do we care what dogs want to watch? Well, the research was done by scientists who study vision and vision loss in dogs. One challenge in testing dogs' vision is getting them to look in the same direction for a while. So knowing that dogs like dog TV is a good first step in the research. According to the findings, quoting from other Rob's piece, 89% said their dogs were most interested in animal content, especially dogs on screen. 26% said their dogs enjoyed watching ball sports. 17% said vehicles. 16% said non-ball sports. Maybe we need some more dogs here on the radio. Dog news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the connection between hearing loss and the risk of dementia and research into efforts to help lower that risk. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Sarah Hopeful with a reflection on parenthood.
The quiet, snowy days of winter have a way of compelling us to reflect on our lives. For writer Jill Sisson-Quinn, a sledding excursion in central Wisconsin with her son teaches a bittersweet lesson of growing and letting go.
For a state mostly flattened by a glacier, finding a good sled hill can be a problem. My son and I can walk through the cornfield behind our house to a gentle slope, or drive to Nelsonville, where a steep hill descends to a refurbished playground. Soon enough, the walkable hill loses its luster, and my son prefers Nelsonville for more thrills. Then, he wants to sled with friends, not me. He's still too young to just drop off, so I'm often stuck there as the chilly chauffeur, where, watching them, I must throw caution to the wind and let kids be kids. Each time we arrive, my son scans the hill for school friends. One day, some middle school boys he doesn't recognize sit in a circle mid-hill around their snowboards. My son, a second grader, is taller than some of them. We trek up the hill, and one of the boys nods at my son's snowboard and says in greeting, "What's your best trick?" "Jump turn," my son replies, without missing a beat. I imagine he's making this phrase up, and I doubt he can do it because he spent only 2 days practicing with the snowboard on a frozen snowdrift in the yard. But he answers with such definitiveness, the older boy seems convinced, and we walk by, having gained entry to use the hill, it seems. My son would rather watch the older boys than use his board. I sit in the cold snow, feeling like I'm at a party I wasn't invited to. Odd after so many years of that symbiotic relationship one has with infant and toddler-aged children. I notice the boys, my son included, gathering at a picnic table near the playground. After some struggle, they manage to pull it several yards so the top of the table is flush with the lip of a snow ramp they have previously built at the hill's bottom. My initial thought is to march over and say, put that table back where it was. After all, I'm the only adult around. Someone's going to break their neck. Isn't it my responsibility to put a stop to this? But another part of me knows that soon enough I'll be dropping my son off at this hill and leaving like the parents of these older kids. I won't always be around, won't know what's going on. And isn't it their responsibility to challenge themselves to try new things, to know when not to. I look around, half hoping a window will go up in one of the houses and a parent will start yelling. But the homes are shut tight against the cold. The boys and I seem to be the only people on this frozen planet. I make a quick decision not to say anything, fully aware it may be the wrong one. I watch the group walk to the top of the hill and get on their boards. At first, they glide down and go to the right or left of the ramp, checking things out, except for my son, who continues as spectator. Then, one boy goes all the way down the hill, up the ramp, across the table, and lands deftly on his feet. A few others follow. No one wipes out. It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. The formulation of an idea, the cooperation to create the challenge, the initial caution, and the pure and easy athleticism of the body when all it is doing is growing and growing and growing. I think about my son's entry into this world of tricks, of cooperation and competition, of finding his place amongst peers. I feel moored by both his confidence and caution. Still, I breathe in a long, slow breath, one I may not exhale for many years.
Jill Sisson-Quinn is a writer who lives in Scandinavia, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Sarah Hopeful.
This is Central Time. Studies from the last couple of years show that hearing loss is linked to an increased risk of dementia. While more research is being done to find the cause of that connection, taking care of your hearing is an important step in improving cognitive function and quality of life in old age. Our next guests are here to help us break down the most recent research and explain what we can do to keep our hearing and our minds sharp as we get older. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or a loved one struggle with hearing loss because of old age? Have you noticed a difference in cognitive function in one way or another? Do you have questions about potential connections between hearing loss and dementia? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Nathaniel Chin is an associate professor in the Division of Geriatrics and Gerontology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's medical director at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. He hosts the podcast Dementia Matters. Nate, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Kimberly Mueller, assistant professor in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at UW-Madison, member of the Cognitive Communication and Aging and Neurogenic Disorders Laboratory. Kim, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nate, let's start with this connection, potential connection between hearing loss and dementia. Now, I know there are lots of risk factors that we look at with various forms of dementia. Can you talk about this potential hearing loss connection?
Yes, hearing loss is actually thought to be one of the major potential risk factors in the development of dementia when we look at an analysis of all of the data. And we can't show yet that hearing loss is the exact cause, but we can see from longitudinal observational studies like the RAP study that people with hearing loss later in life have a higher risk of developing dementia.
And then, Nate, that would make me think, okay, well, maybe if we can fix hearing loss with various kinds of hearing aids, can we maybe prevent dementia? And that, it sounds like, is what a lot of the active research is trying to puzzle out.
You are absolutely correct. You know, from a good observational study, you then have questions about, well, is this causing it? And if so, what can we do about it? And so these interventional studies are being conducted, and one has been done, looking to see if we can actually treat this and reduce the risk of future declines.
We'll get into the results of some of that research in a bit. But Kim, I want to bring you in on this now. Now, I have relatives who have had hearing loss slowly developing, slow to diagnose. And for a while, you might not be able to tell if it was cognitive decline or hearing loss. How do we start to tease those out and the connection between the two?
Right. That's a really good question. I think, first off, if there is any hint that there's a hearing loss, the first thing someone should do is talk to their doctor about it. Teasing those two things apart is one of the big questions that we have in the research, but we do know that hearing aids can really help people to think clearer, essentially, because they're not thinking as hard. They're not working as hard to hear the sounds in the environment. So a hearing aid can kind of reduce what we call cognitive load. And sometimes you see people look like their memory has improved once they've been acclimated to a hearing aid.
That's interesting. And Kim, even without this dementia connection, that sounds pretty valuable. Can you talk about the benefit to, a little more about the benefit to our ability to think clearly, our ability to remember things, if we can tackle hearing loss?
Yes. And so there have been many studies to show just overall benefit by wearing hearing aids in later life. And so one of the main benefits is an improved quality of life. And more socialization. So sometimes when people have hearing loss, it's a lot of work to go to a party, to a restaurant, and try to hear the conversation. And so sometimes people withdraw. But what we know is that hearing aids can increase socialization and better outcomes in terms of health-related quality of life. And in some studies, you see even reductions in self-reported pain after wearing a hearing aid for 3 months. And so it really can have a lot of benefits in terms of not only cognition, but quality of life.
And Nate, let's get back into now that question we were tackling earlier. Does addressing hearing loss help with dementia? Now, before we called the two of you up, we looked at two studies that seemed at least positive for people at risk of dementia saying, hey, yeah, hearing aids addressing hearing loss might help reduce the risk of dementia. You pointed out one of those has since been retracted. What kind of confidence, what do we know at this point about whether addressing hearing loss, apart from those day-to-day benefits, can help with dementia?
Well, there was one study that has not been retracted. It's actually a really important study by Dr. Frank Lin called ACHIEVE. And this one showed that in a certain subset of people, those that actually reflect more of the general public and have more risk factors than healthy individuals, that when they had hearing aids in, there was a reduction in cognitive decline, not necessarily impairment, so not diagnosis, but cognitive decline over the 3-year period. And so while the overall study, if someone were to look up ACHIEVE, they would say, well, the study was equivocal, it was not successful. When they looked at that smaller group, there was a pretty profound benefit in wearing hearing aids.
We're with Dr. Nathaniel Chin, associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health and medical director at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, and Kimberly Mueller, assistant professor in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at UW-Madison, member of the Cognitive Communication and Aging and Neurogenic Disorders Laboratory. We're talking to them about the connection between hearing loss and dementia and hearing loss and our memory and cognitive decline. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one dealt with hearing loss? Have you gone to a professional for help? What kind of difference did it make if you got some sort of assistive device that helps with your hearing? Do you have questions about risk factors for Alzheimer's, for cognitive decline as we age? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Kimberly Mueller in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at UW-Madison and Dr. Nathaniel Chin with the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. We're talking about hearing loss and the risk of dementia. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Kim, I want to ask about some of your work on, you know, those speech changes, those language changes we might have in the early stages of dementia. Now, a lot of people as they age might have some language changes and think, is this an early sign of dementia? How do we start to tease that out?
Yes, very good question. So my research looks at very subtle changes to speech and language as people age and as they have a risk of dementia, so with other risk factors. And it is hard to tease out as a person because with normal aging, we have a decline in how quickly we can retrieve words. And so it is difficult to tease those two things apart. So if you're having trouble thinking of words, a lot of times that is just part of normal aging. And so what we're trying to do is really understand what is different on this trajectory toward dementia versus typical aging.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Linda is with us in Crivitz. Linda, hi.
Hi. My comment was that I was raised by two parents who had hearing impairment their whole life. And because of the hearing impairment, they were isolated a lot. And my mom, in later years, developed dementia. And I'm wondering how much isolation has to do with the hearing loss because of being raised in that community, knowing that a lot of these people do isolate themselves.
Linda, interesting question. Thanks for the call. Nate, is it hearing loss itself or the isolation that can result from untreated hearing loss?
Well, I think Linda brings up a really important point, which is one of the proposed mechanisms of hearing loss and its relationship to dementia or cognitive change is the lifestyle that changes with it. So people are less social. They're actually isolated. They're less likely to engage in thinking activities that involve sound. And so I think there's a lot of people who would believe, yes, that was a part of it. Would I say it's the primary driver? You know, it's always so difficult to know, Linda, but I certainly think it was a factor. And I think it's one of those things that for future generations, if we can address these early on, we hopefully won't live the same exact lives of our parents.
Thanks a lot for that call, Linda. Linda, it sounds like her parents had long running hearing impairments. What are some of the barriers that stand in the way of people of any age, knowing that they have hearing loss, getting it diagnosed and then getting it treated?
Yes, good questions. I think the main barrier is getting a hearing evaluation. A lot of people don't have access to that or don't know that that's even available. So that's one barrier. Unfortunately, another barrier is stigma of hearing loss. And so for whatever reason, sometimes people feel embarrassed about it and so don't want to get a hearing aid because it might make them look older or they might be treated differently. And, you know, that's one of the things along with the stigma of dementia that we really need to change in society and thinking about screenings for older adults as they age, regular screenings at the doctor about, you know, whether or not an audiological evaluation is necessary.
We got a comment or a question actually from Tom in Milwaukee wondering, how about people who are already fully deaf? Is there any research into deafness and dementia, Nate?
And so there is not a lot of research into people who are born with deafness in particular and how that impacts them throughout life. But when we think about these potential causes that hearing loss can have on cognitive change, you know, Dr. Miller already mentioned there's this idea that your brain is actually using more energy and resources to help decipher the hearing loss. Well, individuals who have deafness don't have that in that brain struggle. And so maybe that mechanism doesn't exist for them. Also, they're able to compensate. They've lived a life, hopefully a meaningful life, without having hearing. And so they're not going to be isolated the way it's someone who acutely loses their hearing. So while science is still behind and there is not a lot of research on this, I do think that's different for someone who has had longstanding deafness or born with deafness versus someone who has now lost it 70, 80 years later into their life.
Let's go back to our callers now. June is with us in Iowa County. June, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering, does it matter if you wear a generic hearing aid versus one of the more expensive kind that are adjustable to the specific pitch you are low in?
June, thanks for the call. Kim, I know, again, from Family Connections and probably my future, there's a lot of variety out there when it comes to hearing assistive devices. Does that matter? Do different kinds help us in potentially different ways?
Yeah, so I think that any hearing aid is going to provide some benefit for cognition and for everyday life. Though it doesn't necessarily have to be more expensive, but if it's possible to get a hearing evaluation from an audiologist and it's possible to get a fitting from an audiologist, it doesn't have to be the most expensive hearing aid, but that's the best route because they really can tune the hearing aid to your needs. And as you go about your daily life, you go back and get retuned. And so there's a lot of help when you use an audiologist. That said, there's now approval for over-the-counter hearing aids, which you can buy at Costco or Walmart or any kind of place like that. And those range in price from $99 all the way to $1,000. And you know, those don't have the same fine-tuning personalization. But again, they're not harmful, and if anything, they're going to be helpful. So it's not necessary to get the most expensive pair to get the most cognitive benefit. I think any hearing aid will be helpful.
Thanks again for that call, June. I want to ask each of you what kind of research you think we still need, what you're watching, what you're hoping we can see when it comes to hearing loss and dementia. Nate, let's start with you. What is your big research question?
With me, because I'll take the easier one and I'll make Dr. Miller take a harder one. And I think it is these interventional studies. We need to have a larger group of people that are representative of the population and who have hearing loss and who do not have thinking changes or at least impairments, and then have hearing aids and see over time, 3 years, 6 years, 10 years, does this lead to slower decline? Does it avoid a diagnosis of dementia? We need that type of clinical trial.
And Kim, what are you hoping to see, whether it's your own crew, your own lab doing this, or research around the country?
I think that, you know, there's a group of people that really need to study more and help, and that's people who are already living with dementia or mild cognitive impairment and have hearing loss. And so our group is working with Northwestern University to see if people who have mild dementia or mild cognitive impairment can have the same benefit from hearing aids, particularly the over-the-counter hearing aids, as other adults who don't have dementia. So, you know, we need to help the people who are living with dementia just as much as preventing it.
We'll leave it there. Kim, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Nate, thanks for being back with us.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Nathaniel Chin, Associate Professor in the Division of Geriatrics and Gerontology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's Medical Director at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. You could listen to him on his podcast. He hosts Dementia Matters. And Kimberly Mueller is an Assistant Professor in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at UW-Madison, member of the Cognitive Communication in Aging and Neurogenic Disorders Laboratory. We talked to him about the link between hearing loss and dementia, what the research says, and what we can do about it. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a pilot program allows Florida to import prescription medicines from Canada. It's an effort to bring down drug costs. We'll look at the plan, the impact it might have, and find out whether Wisconsin and other states could join in. Plus, what is your first childhood memory? The host of a new podcast tells us about the value of thinking back to our earliest memories. We'll invite you to share yours. That's tomorrow here on Central Time.